Hello, this is Russ Winter from the Techie Geek Podcast, and I'm recording an episode for Hacker Public Radio. I saw an appeal by email for some shows on some topics that might be non-computer related, and I have one I've been meaning to do for a while. When I was at the Northeast Linux Fest this past St. Patrick's Day weekend up at Harvard University, I was at the Hacker Public Radio table speaking with Claude2's companion. I'm sorry, I forget her hacker name, but she was lovely. And I was talking with her about this idea I had for an episode of Hacker Public Radio where I would speak about a hobby I used to be very involved in. That was using and shooting flintlock muzzleloader rifles. For a period of about 6 to 7 years, 1989 through 1995, I was heavily involved in my area of Pennsylvania shooting flintlock muzzleloader rifles in a type of competition that is referred to, at least in my part of the country, as a rifleman's walk or a woods walk. And what this is, where you would navigate an obstacle course of very challenging shots that would vary in difficulty of the shots, normally about 20 shots, and you would go through this course with a group of 5 to 10 other shooters, and there might be 2, 3, 4 squads go through the course depending on how many would show up that day for the shoot. And it might take you 2.5 to 3, 4 hours even to go all the way through the course. And then when you return to the clubhouse, you would wait for all the squads to come in, and then the scores would be tallied, and prizes would be selected. A lot of times these were what they called blanket shoots, which means every shooter arrives with a prize. You put the prize out on the blanket, or most of the time it was a table. And then the first place shooter got first choice of the prize on the table, so on and so forth, until the last place shooter got what remained. They were a lot of fun. I used to do this with my dad. We would go muzzleloader shooting, and it was great fun. At one time, I was really good at it. Those who know me know that I'm normally a pretty humble person, but when my eyesight was perfect and everything was spot on for the day, I would routinely get 17, 18 shots on. And some of these shots, the scoring was always done simply hit or miss. And these were steel targets, so if you made the target even wiggle, it was considered a hit. And if it, you know, was miss, it was pretty obvious. So many of these targets would be out 50 yards or further, and I could routinely hit a 6-inch plate at 100 yards. I've been able to hit 3/4-inch rebarb steel hanging vertically at 50 or more yards. One of my favorite targets would be a baggie of lime, like you would put on your lawn. Lime powder, and this would be inside a tube, a steel tube, at maybe 50 yards or further, you know, and you would shoot at it, try to get your ball inside the 1-inch tube, and when you hit it, there'd be an explosion of white powder from the lime dust going out. So it was great fun. Now, the main thing I want to talk about is the flintlock ignition, and why it was so popular in its day and remains to be so. I'm quite fortunate that I live in an area that is steeped in history, and about 45 minutes from my home, there's a firearms shop that is primarily dedicated to muzzle-loading firearms. It's called Dixon's Muzzle-Loading Shop, and it was and still is the place where I acquire most of my shooting supplies. And every year, the last weekend of July, they have a free event called Dixon's Gunmakers Fair. If this is a topic that interests you and you can get there, you definitely want to go there. It's an amazing show. People from all around the world come to this weekend event. It's free. They charge a little bit for parking, like $2 to park. But admission to the event is free, and you will see the best of the best at this show. Now, because it's for gun makers, it's primarily the art of gun making, but also like powder horns and possible bags and flints and all the supplies you would ever need to acquire for flintlock muzzle loading. So if there's any way you can get to Dixon's Gunmaker Fair, you definitely want to. So the history of the flintlock, I'll put some links in the show notes, but when you begin to research this, you'll see that it's widely disputed when the flintlock first came into existence. But considering up to and including the time of the American Civil War, it enjoyed a period of several centuries as the primary form of firearm ignition. Okay, so, you know, as far as the history of firearm ignitions go, it's been around longer than any in popular use. I mean, if you consider, like, the centerfire cartridge became popular maybe in the early 1900s. So we're talking a little more than 100 years ago. The flintlock ignition system reigned for possibly as long as 3.5 to 4 centuries. And if you consider its popularity today, it's still a very popular ignition system. Now, what's interesting, I used to go to these muzzle-loading events. Those in technology are familiar with the disputes that go on between people who are into Windows versus Linux versus Mac, or within the Linux, what distro you prefer, or heaven forbid, your favorite text editor. You know, the famous disputes between VI or Emacs. Well, let me tell you, the spirited discussions that go on about whether your preference is for percussion cap or flintlock ignition, they go on and on. Why was the flintlock preferred even through the years that the percussion cap reigned? Well, you know, this is interesting because, you know, you would think, you know, the percussion cap is so much easier and supposedly more reliable, right? You have a tin of percussion caps, and basically all you need to do is put it on the nipple, cock your firearm, fire, and you're good to go. But there's a lot of problems with the percussion cap ignition system. Just to name a few, there's no way to fire that weapon without a supply of percussion caps. If your supply of caps goes missing or gets wet, you might as well use your rifle as a club because you're not firing that. With a flintlock, if you happen to run out or lose your flints, you can get by with just about any stone off the ground that's of the approximate size. You might only get 1, 2, 3 shots out of that stone versus a quality English or French flint, but you know, it will be able to shoot. The other thing is, in wet or rainy or snowy weather, you would think that a flintlock would be a lot more trouble to keep dry than a percussion, but not necessarily so, especially keeping your caps dry or getting a dry cap on the nipple while it's raining or snowing or something. With flintlocks, there's a leather cover called a cow's knee, because they used to be literally made out of a cow's knee. They're roughly shaped to go over the flintlock area. And with using things like grease or beeswax or other, you know, commonly available water repellents, you could keep your powder dry, which is a popular term among muzzleloader shooters. Keep your powder dry. Also, if your flintlock got wet, there were ways to get it dried out relatively easily, at least compared to getting a percussion cap gun dried out. Some of the other reasons that flintlocks are preferred, if you look on YouTube or, you know, just Google, you'll find some high-speed videos. Some are better than others, but you can actually see that a flintlock, when properly tuned and set up, is actually able to fire faster than a percussion cap. And the reason for this is a percussion cap cannot fire until that hammer is all the way down on the cap and fires the cap. A flintlock, when properly tuned, is already producing sparks perhaps less than half of the way down the frizzen, and those sparks are entering the pan, and when it sets off the priming charge, the radiant heat goes through what's known as the touch hole, ignites the main charge, and it is possible for a flintlock to fire before the hammer is all the way down. Now, tuning your flintlock with such precision takes a little time, but it's actually fun. I mean, if you're listening to Hacker Public Radio, you're interested in hacking, and tuning your flintlock to fire properly is surprisingly a lot like hacking. So let me talk a little bit about the flintlock itself, the actual ignition part. So I'm mostly familiar with custom-built guns, but and especially the lock mechanisms made by the Seiler Lock Company. And a little side note, if you ever watched the TV series Heroes, where the villain was known by the name Seiler, I got a special kick out of that. But anyway, the Seiler Lock Company is my favorite manufacturer of locks. I've bought pre-built ones, and I've also built locks from kits, which are also fun. But basically what you are looking for, you know, the lock is a relatively simple mechanism, but each mechanical part plays a very specific role, and I could do an hour-long episode just on the lock mechanism itself. But primarily the most important thing for the lock is the flint that you choose. Okay, a lot of people mistakenly think that the flint is what sparks, but actually the flint is just the abrasive mechanism that comes down on the hardened metal known as the frizzen, and it's actually metal sparks coming off the frizzen that ignite the charge. First, finding a supplier of and then selecting the proper English or French flint is probably the most important part of getting your lock tuned, because if you choose a flint that's too large or too small, you already have problems. You want the flint that has the proper edge and the proper size for your lock. Also, a mistake that a lot of people make is they put much too much powder in their priming pan. When you fill the priming pan with priming powder, you'll get a lot of the powder inside the hole that goes from the pan to the main charge. That hole is referred to as a touch hole, and you do not want powder to go in that hole. That creates a fuse. You will get delayed fire, also known as a hang fire, or among people who shoot flintlocks regularly, we call that a hang bang. You don't want that. That's going to increase the likelihood that you're going to miss your target or flinch. Again, a properly tuned flintlock is going to fire before the hammer or cock is all the way down, and that's what you want. So it's the radiant heat of that charge going off, and the radiant heat goes through the touch hole and sets off the main charge. One of the things, and you can see this in videos, is if you've never shot a flintlock before, getting accustomed to that flash going off about 10 inches in front of your face takes a little bit of getting used to. And I mean, if you don't follow through or you flinch, you know, you're going to miss your target. One way you can practice getting used to that is by not loading your firearm and just, you know, of course, in a safe location, just practice setting off priming charges. You never want to work the flintlock mechanism with no flint in the jaw. You'll bend the jaw screw, and you know, it's like dry firing a bow or something without an arrow. It's just not good and you shouldn't do it. But when you're building or working on your flintlock, especially when it's out of the gun, it's safe to put a flint in there and just, you know, work on tuning your gun. A little safety tip. It is quite possible, and I've seen it demonstrated, that you can fire a flintlock without any powder at all in the priming pan. What'll happen, there's two different ways this can happen. Again, I saw this demonstrated probably 15 years ago at a gun maker's fair. So some people think that when you come in from hunting with a flintlock or something, that you can just dump the priming powder out of the pan, maybe blow away some of the powder that might seem to be stuck there, and then you're safe, leaving the charge in your gun. What I would warn you against is, even when you blow away the powder, you can see there's microscopic powder stuck to that pan, and that's all that's needed. Okay. Also, with a completely clean pan, it is possible, if you're making lots of sparks, for a spark to make its way into the main charge and still fire the gun. It only takes a Also, when you're firing your muzzleloader, you want to keep all your priming powder and main charge powder far away from where you're shooting, because the flash, you know, fire coming out in the direction of the touch hole, there's gases escaping, so you don't want anybody standing. Like, if you're right-handed, you don't want anybody standing off to your right side. They're going to get sprayed with exhaust gases coming out of the touch hole. And if you're, you know, your shooting bench is off to your right and you've got a can of powder or your priming powder there, it's happened. If you go to Dixon's, you'll see exploded powder horns and priming cans and stuff where accidents have happened. So after you load and prime your gun, you want to walk a good distance away from your loading table before you shoot. A little bit about the proper charges. Most people, when they start out, use way more powder than they need to. You know, if you get like a Thompson Center or Lyman production made gun, the manuals that come with that will recommend that you use a powder charge. It's probably about twice as much as you need, maybe more. My primary gun that I used for target shooting and hunting was made by Cabin Creek Muzzleloading in York, PA, known as their Yorktown model. I've probably put thousands of rounds through this gun. And the charge that works best for target shooting and hunting is 55 grains of 3F. I've killed many deer with that charge, and I've also won many competitions with that charge. So, it's produces plenty of accuracy and power. Now, developing your charge, a couple things that really come into play is selecting the proper patch and ball. This takes a little bit of experimenting. What I would recommend, if you have the ability to get into a muzzle loading shop, or maybe you have to order your supplies online, I would suggest starting with a ball that is 10/1000ths of an inch smaller than your bore, with a patch that's 12 to 20/1000ths in thickness. And selecting the proper patching, or ticking, or pillow ticking as it's sometimes known as, is an art form. That's all I can say. Working up this combination, especially with lube you use, there's production lubricants made by a company called Wonder Lube that are good. A lot of old timers make their own from beef tallow, or you can even use Crisco vegetable shortening, which will work well. The primary thing is, you never want to use anything petroleum based. It needs to be a natural fat based lubricant. So I often used Wonder Lube ticking. I had very specific need for my ticking. As I recall, I was using ticking that was 14 to 16 thousandths thick, And about once a year or so, I would go to my local fabric store with a micrometer and would actually measure the thickness of pillow ticking and then buy a yard or two of pillow ticking that was the perfect thickness. And then I would make my own patches. I've molded my own balls, and I've also purchased what are known as swedged lead balls. Basically, it's just a lot easier to buy them already made. If you're into hacking and you like to do things yourself, by all means consider, you know, molding your own balls, but the swedge balls are a lot easier. I settled on using Hornady brand, and my load would be a 490 Hornady swedged lead ball with a 14 to 16 thousandths patch in my 50 caliber Cabin Creek Yorktown with 55 grains of 3F and just a tiny bit of 4F powder in the priming. Just a little tip, in a pinch you can use any powder for the priming charge. I've already used the 3F that I use in my main charge for a quick follow-up shot if needed. So what else can I tell you? A little bit about the accuracy. A muzzleloader, when it's properly set up, has amazing accuracy. There's a lot of urban legend, so to speak, that muzzleloading rifles were, you know, very inaccurate, especially against today's production guns. And I would argue to say quite the opposite. Also, back in the day, when people could only afford to have one gun, people who only had one gun knew how to use that gun well, and they used it for sport and for hunting and for putting meat on the table and for protecting their homes and their livelihoods, their freedoms and liberties. So you better believe they knew how to use their guns. You know, the famous Sergeant York legend of World War One. He was an expert muzzleloader shooter. That's where he learned to shoot. And even after the war, he remained active in the muzzleloading sport right up to the time of his passing. So a very interesting person. You never saw the movies or read anything about Sergeant York. You need to look into that. So I've gone on about 20 minutes about this, and if this is something you found interesting, send me a note. I could go on and on and on about the flintlock muzzleloading ignition system, pistols and long rifles and shotguns. I've enjoyed many years of shooting them in competition, just for fun in the backyard and also for hunting. It's a great sport, really gets you in connection with history. There's a lot of reenactments that go on. I used to also kind of softcore participate in something known as primitive trekking, which was basically what I would do is overnight camping, where I would just head out into the woods with the bare minimum of things, no food, maybe just a little water. And if I couldn't get a squirrel or something, I didn't eat for a day. I slept on the ground. It was and is probably one of the most interesting ways to see what our forefathers dealt with when they first came to the Americas. You know, again, I could do special episodes on that too. If you're interested in that, probably one of the most well-known authors that writes about trekking, his name's Mark Baker. I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can read about some of his trekking adventures. So that's going to do it for this episode of Hacker Public Radio. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you like to contact me, you can email me at russ@thetechiegeek.com. You could also check out mine and Tracy Holt's podcast at thetechiegeek.com. I'd love to hear from you. So for now, good night and God bless.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.